right. I'm Terrell, the post reader.
Hi, Terrell.
I'm passing around a picture because a lot of times people just don't believe that I used to be fat. My top weight is somewhere over 300 pounds, and I have 23 years of abstinence. So that's like one of the things, like, so like it's a small group, you can just sit down and go, okay, last questions away, because, you know, that's just like speaking up in itself. But I can tell you a little bit what it used to be like, so you know that I know what it means to binge. I come from an alcoholic family, so I learned at an early age that I had to get out of my family at a very early age. I just had to get away from me. My parents had alcohol, my sister had heroin. Other people, you know, I discovered food at a very early age, and it got me out. And so by the time I was 8 years old, I was about 20 pounds overweight. And by the time I was in high school, senior in high school, I was probably, about 120 to 150 pounds overweight. So it's just a progressive disease. It just progressed. I got worse and worse. I never really tried diets. Because I was told that the best diet I could do is to push myself away from the table. That there is, you know, that, I mean, I kind of had all this from the very beginning that says, I was taught in school, body's a furnace, calories in, calories out. If you don't burn up calories, or if you, you know, then you're going to store those calories. I mean, I had all those concepts down. But we were talking about food, so there was a total disconnect between my eating and this calories in, burning calories, and what to do my body with these extra calories. It wasn't about food and nourishment. It was about my comfort, my solace, my friend, my love, it was everything. So it was kind of like this total disconnect between what they were talking about over here and what I was talking about over here. So they said, okay, you go to the one lose weight. I knew I had to eat less food. What brought me to the program was I was miserable. I mean, you can't be looking like this in high school, being, you know, and having a fabulous life. I was not one of those happy-go-lucky fat kids. I was a miserable fat person. I hated myself. I never bathed because I didn't want to. It's just the concept of touching my body was horrible. It was just self hatred that ran rampant. So I wound up coming to the program when I was 17, in like 1973, and I was because my stepfather berated me so much. He was berating me constantly about it. I was fat, and I didn't have any friends, and all I did was come home and watch from school and watch TV, and want to get out of the house and do something with my life, and just, I mean, all the stuff that I told myself, but my stepfather was also telling me, and not in a kind, loving way. He was telling me the same way I was telling myself, which is very hateful, very vindictive, and very evil. I've left to my own devices, my brain was out to tell me the most god-awful things about myself I could possibly come up with. Anyway, what happened was, I went to my first meeting, and at my first meeting, this man said he had lost 100 pounds. And I went, oh my God, it can be done. I had, in my mind, there was like these, you know, the comic books, at the back of the comic books, there was this guy before and this guy after. And it really looked like the guy was sticking out his stomach of it before, and after he was sucking it really in, and those were the before and after pictures. I'm thinking like, okay, so he had, you know, it doesn't make any difference whether it's before or after. It's just, you know, what's 15, 20 pounds? It's nothing when you weigh, you know, when you're a 100 pounder. But when this man said he lost 100 pounds, I thought, oh my God, it can be done. Because it gave me hope. Because I believed him. And I believed that if he could do it, I could do it. And see, before this, I had this concept in my head that there was two types of people in this planet. There was thins and there was fat. And occasionally a thin became a fat, but a fat never became a thin. So here I am, 300 pounder. I'm never going to be thin. It was a hopeless, useless, why am I even bother trying? Why? It's hopeless. But when I got my first meeting, I got hope. And that's why I said, if you get nothing else out of my talk, here are the fact that I have lost over 100 pounds and have kept it off for over 23 years. So, I mean, that should say something about what this program has done. And that you can do it too. The program is very clear. It's about we. It's not that something I did special. The problem, though, about Obesity Anonymous back then, well, besides the fact that there weren't very few men, and there weren't a lot of kids, a lot of, you know, young people, but there, you talked about steps, and I didn't need steps. I did this for my sick alcoholic parents. All I needed was lose a little weight, get a few friends, my life become wonderful. And that's all I needed was lose a little weight, get a few friends, my life be wonderful. And that character defect that says, I will be wonderful if I can just lose a few more pounds and maybe get a little bit more popular, then my life will be fine. And that character flaw, even to this day, sometimes bugs me, or it comes up and bites me in the ass. And then you also talked about God, and I was raised Baptist, very, very religious Baptist, and I knew about God, and God was all-powerful and omnipotent. And I knew that since God was in control of everything, I knew that since I was a 30-pound fat kid, I knew that was God's will. And I know the reason why God wanted me fat was it was his punishment for me for all those deep, dark secrets that I carried, for all those horrible things I had done the first 17 years of my life. I'm a 17-year-old kid, and I know that my punishment on this planet is to be 300 pounds and have alcoholic parents. Because that's what God was—that was punishment meted out to me because of who I was. Which, you know, when you look back upon it, a 17-year-old kid thinking that he deserved that much punishment from a God. And I always say that if you have a hard time with the third step, I turn your willing life under the care of God, then fire that asshole of a God you got. You need to get a different God that's not going to be so punishing. And you also talked about the fourth step, which means I had to tell people my deep dark secrets, share with you who I was. And one of the reasons that I was eating, and I know one of the reasons, I should say, well, I didn't know back then, but I believe that we, us compulsive eaters, every compulsive eater I've ever met eats over their sexuality. And my sexuality at that time, I knew that I liked boys, that I wasn't attracted to girls. And I knew from a very early age that I was attracted to boys. And I knew that God looked at me being Baptist and everything. I know that God was saying, so you're a homosexual? Well, you're going to be fat. We're going to give you alcoholic parents because of all those sinful, horrible thoughts you've had. And so that was my punishment, was I had to be 300 pounds. I now know that I ate over my sexuality because I couldn't cope with my sexuality because I didn't know how to deal with my sexuality. The reason why I think we compulsive eat over the sexuality because it wraps up intimacy, wraps up relationships, it wraps up body images, all into one little bundle called sexuality. And I don't care what sexuality you are. I believe just we eat over it. I don't care if you're the most straightest person in the world. You're probably going to wind up eating over your sexuality. If you're the most gay person in the world. If you're into bestiality. If you're not into bestiality. Who knows what you're into? We just kind of eat over it. Because it combines everything into one. That one, those three issues kind of wrapped up in one. So since I couldn't do the fourth step, I really couldn't bother with the program. But I did want to lose 100 pounds. I wanted what that man had. So I took the suggested food plan, which is in a gray sheet of paper, and I followed that food plan. I lost about 125 pounds in about 6 months, 5 months. Yeah, this is a great weight loss program. If you want to lose weight, I mean, I've seen weight loss that's just unheard of and kept up, unbelievably unheard of. So don't tell me like, oh, this isn't a weight loss program. Bullshit, this is a weight loss program. If I told you, we put out in advertisements to people as to get newcomers in the door, we're going to make you serene and happy. I don't understand. I'm like 50 pounds overweight. I won't lose the 50 pounds. That's our hook. That's our hook that gets people in the door. Come on in, lose 50 pounds. Keep your 50 pounds off. We got you that. We can give you that. And then we start talking about the steps and other stuff like that. So, but the fact of the matter is, I want to lose weight. So I took that gray sheet and I lost the weight. And I got down to 175 pounds. But I didn't deal with those things that caused me to overeat in the first place. I never wrote an inventory. I never dealt with those causes, and the effect was overeating. So I never dealt with those causes. Since I didn't deal with those causes, I had no choice but I had to go out and eat again. And I put back on about 75 pounds. And then this little thing happened to me, and we're as sick as our secrets. And that little secret about my sexuality, I was no longer a secret about it. I came out of the closet. And I started dealing with my sexuality, and I started being honest about who I was, and I started being true to who I was, to myself. And I started saying, screw you, this is who I am. And not caring whether you did like it or not like it. This is who I am. And by stating who I am and saying, this is who I am, then I can, it's kind of like a fourth step and a fifth step. And I went to the world, and then I got to remove this character defect. It was just like, okay, this is who I am. And by admitting to who I am, I didn't need to eat over my sexuality. So I got rid of one of those huge things that I was eating over. I came out of the closet. Also, when I was in the closet, you say if you lose the weight, you'll get the girls. And I was like, okay. But after I came out of the closet, if you lose the weight, you'll get the boys. I thought, okay, let's lose weight. So I mean, I mean, vanity is a great, I mean, Lord knows, I'm sure every one of us has lost weight here for vanity's sake. You know, Lord knows I've kept my absence a couple of times for vanity's sake. I'm not, 23 years of absence is not all spiritual driven, I assure you. There's been some white knuckling in here, there's been some, I can't go back in those rooms after 12 years of absence, but I broke my absence. I'm not going to break my absence for that reason. I'm not going to go back in those rooms after, you know, or, oh my God, if I lose, if I break my absence, I'm going to get fat and I won't get any boys. I mean, we have 1,001 reasons why we're not going to, why I don't break my absence. Now, but the long haul is all sex spirituality driven. It's all based upon spirituality. But right here, right this, at this very moment, can I say, oh, I'm totally godsend, I'm totally peaceful and serene, and that's why I'm not seeking excess food? No. I want to lose weight for this dance coming up next week, so maybe I'll just cut back on my carbohydrates. I mean, let's be honest here. So anyway, so I lost the weight. I got back down to about 160 pounds. And I did that. I always mention this because I really believe that a head full of program and a belly full of food gets you nowhere. And one of the things I learned in this program when the first time I came around was that, because the first time I came around, I always like to mention this, that I always come to about a meeting a week, whether I really need it or not, just for moral support and encouragement to say, okay, yes, you're doing great for weight loss. Okay, weight loss up. Yes, weight loss, weight loss, weight loss. So I kept coming back because I wanted the weight loss. I also felt like I was at home here, but I wasn't willing to do what the steps. I wasn't willing to do that. I needed it, but I didn't want to do it. I wasn't willing. I just didn't need to do it. So I was visiting you folks, and I really say I was visiting. I was a tourist. I drop by, I visit, say hello, then I go about my merry way, and so forth. And so I picked up a few of those little cliches. And one of the cliches that I picked up was, it's not the 100th bite that puts the weight on, it's the first. So after I came out of the closet, I found that if I didn't take that first bite all day long, I was safe from the devil food that I have to deal with. Do I stop at the donut stand? Do I not stop at the donut stand? Do I eat this? Do I not eat that? Do I eat this? You know, that mental masturbation that goes on that says about this and about that, not that, you know, just constant. So I said, stop. I'm not going to eat. I'm just not going to eat. And so if I didn't eat, I didn't take that first bite, I had to deal with the compulsion. They talk about our literature talks about there's two things to this disease. There's the obsession of the mind and the compulsion of the body. I can obsess about food all day long, but I don't, obsession is all mental. I can obsess about food all day long, it doesn't put an ounce on me. It's just me thinking about food all day long. But when I take that first bite, then my addiction kicks in, and the compulsion is there, and I have to eat to feed my physical addiction to my food. So I found that if I didn't feed that addiction, if I didn't take that first bite, I didn't have to deal with my addiction. Oh yes, I was obsessed with food, but I didn't eat. So I got down to about 160 pounds. I maintained my weight that way for a couple of years. And I call this my donut diet stage, because basically I would not eat anything all day long. And then on the way home from the discotheque at 2 o'clock in the morning, I would stop and get 9 or 10 donuts. Because it was like one of those things it was always after the discotheque, and I always say it was to deal with rejection, with deal with everyone, like standing in a crowded discotheque with 2,000 guys or 1,000 people, and standing in a corner and being afraid to move my little finger, because I know if I move my little finger, the entire discotheque would turn around, look at me and say, look how you moved your finger. Fat boy, what are you doing here? You're too ugly, you're too fat. Get the hell out of here. You don't belong here. So there I am, and I mean, I'm not self-centered. I mean, mind you, I wasn't self-centered. I wasn't self-obsessed. I was just afraid to move my little finger because then everyone in the discotheque was watching my little finger. So anyway, I was constantly being rejected in my mind by everyone in the discotheque. Though no one was really rejecting me because I was just a wallflower in the corner. No one paying attention to me. You have to be out there to be rejected. You know, if you're not out there, I wasn't rejected. So anyway, deal with all that rejection, I would stop and get 9 or 10 donuts. And I always say it was never a dozen donuts, because if you eat a dozen donuts, you're a compulsive overeater. But if you eat 9 or 10 donuts, you're not a compulsive overeater. Now, that was my rules. And I'm sure everyone in this room has their rules that said, well, if I didn't do that, I'm not a compulsive overeater. Or if I don't do that, I'm not a true compulsive eater. Well, I never ate out of garbage cans. Or I have never ate kibbles and bits for a snack. No, I mean, I'm sure, so you know, that doesn't make me a true compulsive overeater. Okay, so I know I never ordered a dozen donuts and ate at one setting. So I'm not a true compulsive eater. Right, not a true compulsive overeater. You know, look at the picture. I'm a true compulsive overeater. So I maintained my weight that way for a while, and Then for a couple of years, and I mean, God bless the newcomer, because I was talking about my donut diet, and this newcomer came up to me after the meeting one day, and she said, "Terrell, if the donut diet works, why don't you stop?" You know? Okay, so let's make it really clear why I stopped the donut diet. Because I was crazier than cat shit. Okay? I was just crazier than cat shit. You can't live on maybe a green salad, maybe a little something or whatever, and 9 or 10 donuts. You just can't live. You don't have your... I'm starving my body. Anyway, what brought me back to the program the second time around is I put on 30 pounds in 6 weeks. Well, I mean, okay, so does that qualify? Am I a compulsive eater now? True. Okay, and what happened before I put on these 30 pounds in 6 weeks is I was told by a doctor, it was an eye doctor, and he had a hard time getting my prescription. Every time I go there, my prescription has changed. I go again, the prescription is different. Go again, the prescription is different. It's all over the board with my prescription. And he asked me if there was a history of diabetes or hypoglycemia in my family. And I said, yes. My grandmother died that way. I don't know. They took body parts. You know, they took the big toe, then they took the little toe, and then they took the foot, then they took the leg, you know. And then when they took the second leg, that's when she died. So I don't know if it was what was caused her death. I don't know what her death certificate said. But I remember her in the bed, hospital bed, eating hard candies as they're taking her body parts. I'm not going to diagnose my grandmother as a compulsive overeater, but Lord knows if they're taking your body parts because you're eating, you know, because of diabetes, you have no business eating sugar. So anyway, then. So the doctor said, I said, yes, there is a history. And he said, well, he asked me a simple little question, which, you know, it's a very innocent little question. He asked me, am I eating sugar? Well, I'm a compulsive overeater. What do you say? You lie. Maybe once we get in the program, we get a little bit more honest with our food. But even to this day, it's very difficult to be completely honest with what we eat, what we put in our mouth. So as a true compulsive overeater, I lied and I said I'm eating a little. Well, 9 or 10 donuts is not a lot of sugar. I can eat a 3-pound box of See's candy. So 9 or 10 donuts is not a lot of sugar. Well, the doctor told me, he said, Terrell, if you don't stop eating sugar, you'll be blind within a year. I then went to Europe for a vacation, and that's when I put on those 30 pounds in 6 weeks. And I wish I could say it was on Belgian endive and on, you know, French cut green beans, but it was not. It was on Bavarian pastries, Swiss chocolate, you name it. I was binging on nothing but sugar. I was traveling. I had no restraints. I had no work restraints. I had no restraints. I had money in my pocket. And so I binged my way through Europe. And I can remember this very vividly, sitting in a train, stuffing my face full of chocolates, having the book Sugar Blues in my knapsack. I wasn't going to pick that up because if I read it, I'd take responsibility for the knowledge. So no, we're not going to read that now. With binging, my brain's on chocolate thinking, I can still see. I can still see. And when things start to go gray, that's when I'll stop. So where will my disease take me? I am willing to risk my eyesight for one more bite of chocolate bar. I am willing to risk my life for a bite of food. So can I understand my grandmother sitting in that hospital bed, them taking body parts and eating hard candy? You betcha. Bring it on. Bring on that hard candy. Because you know what I said, I want some hard candy. You know, what the fuck is my brain off the leg? What other body part are they going to take from me? So anyway, after gaining 30 pounds and reaching a bottom that I didn't think I'd ever reach, a bottom that was just, I was so demoralized. I came back from Europe. I couldn't see my friends because I had to show up 6 weeks later. And then when I asked about your European vacation, go, oh, well, I guess you enjoyed the French food. You know, I was just totally demoralized. And I called my sister, who was in OA at the time, and I said, I need to dry out. I need to come here. We didn't have eating disorder units. I need to dry out. I tried taking sugar in Europe, and I couldn't do it. I got sick. I physically got ill. And I know that God allowed me to continue eating for a few more weeks to get me back to the United States. Because if I would have done it on my own in Europe, I could have. I would have. And I might not have come back to program. But God said, no, go feed me. And when you get back, I'll take care of you. So I came back to the United States, and I went to my first meeting. Now, I really couldn't do OA. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's what I tell my sister. I really can't do OA because I can't eat like Gracie anymore. And I don't have this life. And, you know, I'm not a middle-aged housewife. What am I going to do in the now? You know. But you know what? It was the last house on the block. I knew this was the last house. in Boston. I knew I had no place else to go. I knew that, I mean, I knew I couldn't go back to my girlfriend. So I came to Overs Anonymous, and I just found out that there was a meeting 6 nights a week at the Gay and Lesbian Community Service Center up in West Hollywood, in Los Angeles. And that became my home group. So I found a place that I fit in. I was going to 6 meetings a week, and I was going to fellowship after the meetings. And then all my life consisted of, I go to work, go to the meeting, go to fellowship, maybe go out dancing, go home, go to bed, wake up, go to work, go to meetings, go to fellowship. That was my life. I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. I started sponsoring people. And then... Wait for me. Okay, and so then so I had this spiritual experience, and the spiritual experience was, I was walking out of Roxbury Park on a Friday night, and we were doing a step study, and we were doing the 12th step. And I'm like thinking, 12th step? I'm like 3 months abstinent or 2 months abstinent. You know, I came back and I got abstinent. I mean, there was like, I was abstinent before I hit my first meeting because I was so desperate. I knew what abstinence was. I knew what it was about. Because that gray sheet of paper saved my life the first time. And I knew it was like no sugar, no flour, and you don't eat carbohydrates, just, you know, period. And so it was, I was like thinking, I don't mean this isn't step study, I'm 12 step. But anyway, I stayed for the meeting, and as I was walking back to my car and I had to cross the park, this calmness and stillness came over me. And I had this little voice from within that says, Taylor, I love you. And you're going to be all right. And you have as much right to be here as is that tree. And it was the first time in my life I didn't believe, or it was just my life, I believed I wasn't following your hair. That you just tolerated me. That I really did have a right to be here. And I never, ever felt that until that moment. And that was my spiritual experience. There's no heaven's part and there's no angel thing, but I knew that that was a spiritual experience. I knew that that was my God talking to me and comforting me and solacing me. And I wish to God I could say that last time I got absent was the last time I got absent, but no, not me. I had one more time to go out there. You know, I was talking a great program. I was sponsoring people. I was doing great. I was looking, people look at me. I mean, I was 20-something, 21, 22 years old, kind of cute, you know, lost that 30 pounds, and I started buying my press releases. People tell me how wonderful I was after 3 months, you know. And I was getting hit on by the guys at the center, and I was thinking, whoa. So I went to my sponsor, I said, you know, I'm sick and tired of going to these rooms full of fat-ass people talking about their problems. I'm sick and tired of being told what I can and cannot eat. I want to go live my life. I want to be out dancing with boys in Palm Springs on a Friday night. I do not want to be sitting at Bellion's meeting. And basically, if I could have, I would turn back my big book and say, here, you can have it back, I'm done with you. But and my sponsor said some magic words to me. He said, Terrell, remember, you're leaving us. We're not leaving you. And if you ever want to come back, we'll be here. Of course, my attitude was, thank you for sharing. Now, this is really wonderful because this was before we even had abandonment issues. We didn't even know what abandonment was. He just knew me as a compulsive reader that would say, listen, Baba, you're checking out. Not us. You are. You took your seat away from you. So you won't bring your seat back in the meeting, you just bring your seat back in the meeting, but we didn't take it away from you. So it was like, okay, fine. So I remember driving home from my sponsor's house, ex-sponsor at that time, because I had just fired him, and I know no longer in program. And I remember thinking, okay, God, you and me, because I'm being very spiritual at this point in time, very spiritual. And we're going to go have some fun, God. Enough with that crazy OA shit. Let's go have some good times. Let's go dance with the boys. Let's have some fun. I'm going to eat what I want, when I want. You know, we're just going to have a good time. And on January 5th, 1979, I binged. I broke that abstinence. And my binge was 2 pieces of toast. And that's it. That's my last binge. I know you might have had that for breakfast this morning. But I am hopelessly addicted to flour. I'm hopelessly addicted to sugar. My abstinence has never, ever included sugar or flour. So if I eat 2 pieces of toast, it is a clear-cut breaking abstinence. And when I ate those 2 pieces of toast, the obsession and the compulsion came pouring back over me with food. Well, all I was thinking about was food, eating more food. And I saw the donut stand. I know exactly where I was going. I'd never been to that donut stand before, but it had warm lights inside, and I was going to go to the donuts. And I thought, oh my God, then I'm going to gain weight. And I'm maybe, oh my God, am I going to gain a gram weight? And I think, oh my God, that means I have to get a scale because the scale's not right. And that obsession came, and I had 3 months of freedom from that obsession. I had 3 months of freedom from the disease, and with two pieces of toast, it came pouring back in. And I got really scared, and I went to bed, I pulled the curtains in my head and said, God, please help me, please help me. Because you folks told me the door will always swing out. But you will never know if the door will swing back in. And I know the door had just swung out. And I didn't know if I had a third time of getting it. I'd been graced twice, but I never had a third time. And I was really scared. I said, God, please help me. I cannot binge one more time. And when I was like, it wasn't about food. I mean, it wasn't about weighing 300 pounds, because I knew that I could keep my weight off of the donut diet. But it was the obsession, it was the craziness that was scared me. That the moral degradation that I took myself, that's what scared me. And so the next morning I got up and called my sponsor and I said, I'm back. I've been back ever since. And now I wish to God I could say, oh, and then I lived happily ever after. But the fact of the matter is, I am a firm believer that the first year, I believe that after you get abstinent, your life is going to go to hell in a handbasket. I just really believe that. Everyone here, your life, when you get abstinent, it just goes to hell. Because the fact that I kind of look at this, you know, it's kind of like I think of like this whole like mob running after me. It's kind of my character defects. They're chasing me, and I'm running around the whole, all over everything with this mob of my character defects running behind me. And trying to catch up with me, and I'm running over here, digging away from them, I'm running over there to catch with them. And also when I got abstinent, I stopped. And what happened is I feel like this entire mob of character defects came running into them, just smacked right into me. You know? Just kept piling up on top of me. And that's what happened to me. My character God. When I finally came out of the fog in my first year, got in my second year, which I got into this relationship, and God bless you when a relationship after, you know, if you're a newcomer, like after the first couple months, you want a relationship. I mean, I understand that desire. I loved high drama, too. I understand high drama. Oh, he loves me. He doesn't love me. Oh, my gosh. He's like, oh, my God. I love that. You know, that was drama. I mean, I understand you had that drama in your first year of absence. You know. But so I waited to my second year. Then I got in the drama. Oh, my God. You know. So what if I cut my hand, taking the knife away from him as he's going to go slash our furniture because he was upset with me? So what if I wound up in the fetal position on the bathroom floor hurting so bad I could hardly stand myself? It was fun. No, if you ask me, then it wasn't fun. But obviously I got a fix off of it because I wouldn't be there in that position if I didn't get some emotional fix off of it. So I now look at that and go, well, of course I enjoyed that. And of course what really clicked for me, I was about 9 months in this relationship and I was talking to my sponsor and she said something like that and it said, and the words came out of my mouth, can I be that? A martyr. And I had answered yes. I'd rather be a martyr than be happy in a relationship. So it was like, okay. So then I started the process of getting out of that relationship. And now I can tell you all the stuff I've been through absent. I mean, I moved to Texas. I got fired from a job, moved to Texas, moved back from Texas, got hepatitis, had no money, was living on handouts on these programs. People shut my doors, took bags of groceries, saying, because I was unable to work because of hepatitis. Somebody bought some groceries here. Didn't ask me for anything, just took care of me. God, I moved back to Los Angeles. I was almost a sole caretaker of my nephew. Just ad infinitum. I found I was HIV positive. Didn't think I was going to live another... I think one of the greatest gifts in my life is the fact that I'm HIV positive. Which to me tells me that I can take anything that my life gives me, and if I give it to God, I can turn around it for a greater joy. Just like my weighing 300 pounds, I turned that around to be a great gift and joy in my life. Maybe an HIV positive. When I found I was HIV positive, I didn't know how long I was going to live. There was like a week time frame when I didn't know what my numbers were. I had not a clue. All I knew was I was positive. And I was planning this trying to decide between two vacations. I found out like in February and March, I was going to either go to Costa Rica in May or Provincetown in July. And I remember thinking, this is a good motion. I better go to Costa Rica in May because I might not be alive in July. And it occurred to me at that moment, in the shower, I faced my mortality. And I started sobbing like I had never sobbed before. My family was around me. They were nervous for me. They were scared. Because it was a gut-wrenching sob. Where my ego died. I died that day. And the greatest gift is, I'm on borrowed time. You are too, you just don't know it. But I am on borrowed time. I'm a 300-pound fat kid who's HIV positive, who came out in San Francisco in 1976. I should be dead. I got a long list of friends that are dead. I should be dead. I'm not. So, I get to look at life every day like, oh my God, I'm breathing. Look, I'm breathing. What a gift. You don't get that unless you face your mortality and, oh my God, I died. Now, you can get that by looking at the seriousness of the disease, compulsive overeating, and go, I can die from this disease. This disease will kill me. And if you know this disease will kill you every day you're abstinent, you can wake up breathing going, oh my God, it's another day. I get to live. And you might not think to binge is to die, but all I got news for you. You take that first binge bite, you just killed your spirit. You just killed your soul. Sure, the body's moving, but the soul's not living. Your soul's not dancing. What it's like today, I'll finish up quickly. This is fabulous. 6 years ago, I started my own business. In 2001 or 2000, I wound up going to about 20 different dance parties around the country where there's thousands of gay men. They're called circuit parties. Thousands of gay men dance with their shirts off. And I'm there dancing with my shirts off. 20 years abstinent. Now, I guess I had to get abstinent and work a 12-step program to go out dancing with the boys. Not what I thought. Not like, okay, I'm fuck the program, I'm gonna go out dancing. No, I'm gonna work this program, I'm gonna sit in a damn meeting. And the first 6, 7, 8 years, 9 years of absence, I did nothing but sit in meetings. I hardly had a social life. Oh well, I have a fabulous social life now. So if you sometimes complain about being in LA all the time and you sit in meetings, oh my God, wait till you stop being a newcomer, like after you get 5 years of absence. Then you can start talking about having a social life. But you're so damaged. I mean, we're all so fucking damaged when we come in the doors. We need to sit 5 years of respite just so we can get healed, so you can go out and act like a normal person, so we can then function like a normal person. So anyway, I'm out dancing with the boys. So 5 years, 6 years ago, I started my own business. Very successful business. Very successful. A year ago, I gave up that business because I got scared. I went for the 401k and stock options and so forth. I went to go work for the software company because it was my future and, you know, I went for the future. I banked my future on this company, these 401k and stock options. Not upon God. The 401k and stock options became my God. The way I got started in business, I said, God, I'm spending more money than I'm making. This job that I have is not making enough money. Either you got to help me stop spending because I can't stop my spending. Or you got to get me another job. I'm willing to wait tables at night. I'll stop going to the gym if I have to. I'll wait tables. Within a month, a coworker of mine came to me and said, Terrell, my fiance's sister has the same program. Can you help with her books once a week? And that led to me having my own business, getting a partner, have some employees. So anyway, I get my business a year ago. What a mistake. I guess I just wasn't really listening to God. I wasn't based upon, you know, I was traveling so much. I was in LA maybe one day out of the month. I wasn't making my meetings. I got out God-centered, and I wasn't listening to God. I was listening to my ego self. So I went for fear. And I went to go work for this company. What a mistake. I moved to Denver. What a mistake. And I wound up managing people, which I didn't want. The reason I left the job, when I stopped being an employee, I said, well, I never have to deal with office politics again. Then I got involved in this corporate world. So anyway, I came back to Los Angeles for 3 months. I went to the CEO of this corporation and said, right, great job. I'm the wrong man. I'm going back to Los Angeles. And either you can keep me as an employee, and I'm going to do exactly what I was doing in Los Angeles, what I was doing before. He said, you just collect the money, you pay me a salary, or I'm going to be your competition. Well, she was no dummy. She kept me on. I did that for 6 months, finally, and I got well enough. My sister died last year, about this in January, which was the most important woman in my most important person in my life, and I was devastated after that. Last January, I had LASIK eye surgery, which had complications, so I could hardly see for a couple of months. All that was last year. It's 2001. It was a hell of a year, 2001. I'm so glad that's over. And so anyway, so when I finally got well enough and gone to enough meetings and got comforted by program enough, I woke up and I said, oh no, I'm not going to do this. You're taking a third of my money and I'm doing all the work here. So I was making plans on quitting in March. Well, once you know, this company that I staked all my future in, my 401k and stock option, went bankrupt on January 16th. So now I'm back being self-employed, doing exactly what I was doing for the last 6 years, except now I'm collecting all the money. God's got a weird sense of humor, if you ask me. So here I am, self-employed again, having a fabulous life. I'm going to go travel to Florida next week, and we're going to work in Florida, the east coast of Florida, and the west coast of Florida. That's hellhole, but I'll go work in the west coast of Florida. Now next weekend, there's a big dance party in Miami. I'm going to be dancing with the boys for 3 days straight, and there's a party on the beach on Sunday afternoon. I'm going to be taking my shirt off, dancing in a bathing suit. Now, you know me, a 300-pound compulsive eater dancing on the beach in broad daylight. You know I've got to be getting pretty well. I'm pretty healed if I'm going to be doing that. Because I have stretch marks. I have flab. I have basset hound skin. You cannot get to 325 pounds as you grow up and not have that. So I've got that. So I don't have that swimmer's body. You know, and we're talking gay men, so we're talking gorgeous bodies. And I just sit there and go, okay, God bless me. Bless me. I'm a child of God. And it's really funny. I now know the longer I leave my shirt on a dance floor, because everyone takes their shirt off on a dance floor, the longer I leave my shirt on, the more I hate myself. The quicker I take my shirt off, the more I love myself. Because every time I keep that shirt on, it's a constant reminder to me that I am not good enough, that I hate me. And I don't hate me. I love my life. I love God. I love what this program has given me. It is the most fabulous thing in the world. And if you are experiencing that right now, right here, right now, well, maybe because you're just so goddamn new, you don't know what's going on. Wait till you get a couple, like maybe 10, 15 years, and then we can talk about your happiness and how wonderful. Oh, it's a journey. Oh, believe me, you'll get better and better and better and better. But don't give up now because you don't have what I got. You can't have what I got at 1 year. Ain't no way you can have what I have at 8 years. Ain't no way you can have what I have at 15 years. You can get 20 years of assets. Oh, my God, baby, it is so fabulous. It's so fabulous after 20 years. And you just heard my last year. It was a hell. But you know what? I was happy through it. And for that, I'm eternally grateful to what you folks have given me. Thanks for letting me share. Okay. Questions?
I have a question. About rejection. What do you do to prevent yourself from allowing rejection to cripple and destroy you?
My sponsor gave me some magic words, or someone gave me some magic words, and it says, man's rejection is God's protection. I get devastated, but you know what? They say, oh, Terrell, you wasn't the right man for you. Oh, Terrell, you know, maybe there's a better one out there waiting for you. That doesn't make me feel any better. Oh, man, right, you know, I wanted that boy. Now I look at that, I also think of like the baby and the shiny toy, which is a knife. And I've had my shiny toys, and that didn't work for me. So that's where I say, okay, God, if I'm to have this relationship, I give it to you. It comes back to me, okay, fabulous. So what rejection is there? Is it God saying, no, my son, this is not good for you? If I give it to God. Now, if I'm ego-driven and say, I want that. I want that relationship. I want that relationship. And it gets rejected. Well, that's my ego. Please, I hope my ego gets rejected all the time. The answer to rejection is God's protection. Yep?
That's nice.
Any other questions?
Can you repeat the question?
Okay. Okay, the question was, how do I keep doing inventories? The classic example that I know about is I was talking to my sister, who was very spiritual in this, She traveled on the country speaking in AA. She was a very, very respected spiritual member of AA. And I was talking to her about one of my problems. I was talking about this, like when I was about 3 or 4 years absent. I was talking about, okay, I've got this problem, And she said, well, did you write about it? I said, yeah, I wrote about it yesterday. She said, you got the problem today? I said, yes. She said, what did you write about it today? Answer the question. You still got the character defect? Then write about it. Stop writing about the character defect when you stop having the character defect. And there ain't, the only way I got news for you. If you do a solid, good fourth step and fifth step, you will be free. I only done one fourth step. I was freed from my fourth step. So I did one fourth step and I got freed. I mean, I found freedom with my fifth step that I cannot talk about. And it wasn't like I woke up and, I mean, it was like as soon as I got to my fifth step, I was free. No, it was a gradual thing over the last next year where I could look back and say, you know what? With my fourth step and fifth step, I told another man in the community exactly who I am, what I am. And they did not run through the room. And now I can look at me and say, I know who I am. So if you call me a son of a bitch, I can look and go, no, I took my inventory. Okay? So that should be good enough. I mean, you're thinking an inventory is a treasury and drudgery and a task. Maybe it's freedom. It's freedom. You should want to do that inventory. You should need to feel like the desire to do the inventory. Okay. Next question. Oh, go ahead. You asked me about how do I know it was absent. I broke my absence, I guess, basically after two pieces of toast. I mean, like I said, it's a lot of breakfast for a lot of people. I believe in a bottom line breakable absence. When I sponsor people, I tell them, open your big book and write down what your absence is. Period. You break right down what your absence is. And don't tell me, oh, I don't know what, you know, well, if you don't know what it is, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, then how the hell do you know if you're absent or not? So you, I mean, I used to, for the first 18 years of my life, my first 10 years of my absence, I had a box. And people said, I didn't come to this concept. Someone told me I had a box. 3 meals a day, nothing in between, no flour, no sugar. Now, I could eat a jungle and still be within the confines of that box because there was no sugar, no flour. But if I ate one bite of German chocolate cake that was sugar or flour, that means there was a break of absence. So I'm very clear, I have a bottom line break of absence. If I have a slice of, if I have a bite of German chocolate cake tonight, guess what? Break of absence. Period. So how do I know I broke my absence? Because I know what my absence is. So can I tell you for the last 23 years I've been absent? You betcha. No, it's not. And a lot of times when I've had some eating in a jungle at a mealtime, I'm like thinking, oh my God, Charles, you're not absent. Oh my God, you just ate like, you know, potato chips and you had this and you had that and so forth. And I have to say like, okay, Charles, did you eat sugar? No, you didn't eat sugar. Did you eat flour? No, you didn't eat flour. Was it a fourth meal? No, it wasn't a fourth meal. Then shut the fuck up. You're abstinent. Any other questions? Well, my sponsor, a lot of people know, is Natalie. And I've had her for 15 years. Maybe a little less. And now it's almost a mutual sponsoring type of thing, which is fine. But if you're new and you're working with a sponsor, or if you're relatively new with your sponsor, you can't have what I have with my sponsor in 1 month, 1 week, or 1 year. It's really interesting. I picked up this new baby who'd been working with a sponsor, a man that I really love and respect, who moved away. And so I took over his baby. His sponsor told him that he should call me, and so I started working with him. And it was in the beginning, it was like this really kind of rocky road, like, okay, it's almost like boom, 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 as we were trying to kick our groove. You know, it's like, I was loving trying to please him that I know I'm not supposed to. I was trying to impress him with my spirituality that I'm not supposed to. He was trying to make me, you know, like, trying to make me happy, you know, as we're trying to feel each other out. And then that's been, I've been sponsored for about 6 months now. And we've hit that groove. We're now laughing. You know what? And it might last another 1 week. And he might find someone else who wants to sponsor him. I don't believe. I hear this all the time. Oh, my God, I can't find a sponsor. I can't find. I'm like thinking, oh, but wait till you get to be my length of absence. You go try and find a sponsor. How long have you been absent? 3 years? 3, 4? Look around you. There's a lot of people out there that sponsor. That can absent 30 days. Maybe you have this 30 days. You can find anyone to be your sponsor because anyone's got more than what you got. Anyone's got more than, I mean, we're going to look at, I mean, if you've got 30-something days, I'm going to look to see nobody in this room like what you got. So if you want to think that you're so special, you got something that you want, everyone in this room wants what you got, uh-uh. So if someone's over here that's got 6 months of absence, they got what you want. Now, if you work with them for a couple months, you might go, I don't know what this person got. I'm going to go to someone else. Make sense? Okay. That's it.